Welcome to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
So what started with a phone call 2 years ago may end in a tweet early next year. The changes in the relationship between the U.S. and Cuba have been dramatic and quiet, slow and significant.
We will hear about the changes from Cubans on the island as well as from Cuban Americans in South Florida. We will talk about the troubled state of the Cuban economy and the uncertain fate of the American strategy of engagement. But first, how we got here.
Well, it was that historic phone call between the White House and Havana, which ended more than a half century of frozen relations between the U.S. and Cuba. Those relations now face an uncertain fate with a new American president-elect and the death of a dictator. Saturday marks the second anniversary of President Barack Obama's actions toward normalizing relations with Cuba. Here's the president on December 17th, 2014.
Yesterday, I spoke with Raul Castro to finalize Alan Gross's release and the exchange of prisoners, and to describe how we will move forward.
2 years later, the Cuba-U.S. relationship moves forward into a future with a new American president and without Fidel Castro. There has been a rush of new deals announced by American companies doing business in Cuba. Royal Caribbean Cruises and Norwegian Cruise Line Holdings were given the go-ahead last week to start selling cruises between the U.S. and Cuba. And the Associated Press reports Google will sign a deal today in Havana that is expected to improve internet access on the island. Internet connections at Cuban homes remains illegal.
Now, the Cuban government approval for these deals comes just weeks before the Trump administration takes over, along with his threat to reverse the policies of the past 2 years. It was 3 days after Fidel Castro's death that President-elect Trump tweeted, quote, "If Cuba is unwilling to make a better deal for the Cuban people, I will terminate deal." Now, Tim, that would certainly mark a huge reversal of 2 years of policymaking by the Obama administration. You know, travel restrictions on Americans visiting the island have been relaxed. The amount and type of stuff that can be imported and exported to and from the island have been expanded. Limitations on who can send remittances to Cuba have been removed, and even banking restrictions have been reduced. So the U.S. now allows Cubans to even open bank accounts here in the United States.
In the meantime, Tom, Cubans keep coming to America. Cuban immigration has more than doubled over the 2 years since President Obama announced the normalization effort. More than 54,000 Cubans came to the U.S. last fiscal year, according to an estimate from U.S. Customs and Border Protection. Most are crossing the Mexican border, but some still brave the Florida Straits. 13 came ashore in the Keys less than a week ago.
Pascal Fletcher was the Caribbean bureau chief for Reuters and the Cuba correspondent for the Financial Times. He joins us here in our newsroom at the Miami Herald in Doral. Pascal, what's the current state of the Cuban economy, do you think?
Well, I certainly think that they themselves acknowledge they're feeling the squeeze from various sources. I mean, we remember in the middle of the year, President Castro himself saying the economy had only achieved something like, 1% GDP growth, and they were aiming for double that. And, the signs are that the squeeze has continued, particularly with a drop-off in oil supplies from Venezuela, and even in the level of support, additional level of support that Venezuela was giving, and from another major ally like Brazil as well.
With millions of American tourists going to Cuba over the last 2 years, with the travel restrictions eased, not lifted, but eased, how do you explain that?
Well, that's the other side, if you like. That's the side where you've got stuff, funds and flowing in. I mean, not just that. I mean, you've got remittances, too. So remittances and tourism, are certainly a major support, if you like, at the moment. And to the extent where many people even say that, the Cuban-American community, the Cuban diaspora, is pretty much bankrolling the Cuban economy. And certainly, parts of the economy like, the private sector, if you like, or the self-employed or quinta propista. So that's the other side of the equation. I think the trouble is that people think that really that also creates a whole load of expectations and an additional kind of squeeze. So they're feeling all these squeezes. There's no question about it.
But Pascal, most then would say, given the situation they're in, that they've got to open up. They have no choice but to open up, particularly with Venezuela having imploded, their one source of, cheap oil. They've got to open up to foreign investment. They've got to open up particularly to American business ventures that are knocking on the door. Why then are they not interested?
I think history's taught us that with the Cuban government, there's no such thing as they've got to. We can recall during the special period, the so-called economic crisis after the fall of the Soviet bloc, everybody said they've got to open up, they've got to change, and they didn't. They toughed it out. And we basically had, I remember that, you know, there was a huge expectation of change, and yet, you know, Fidel Castro came up with the slogan socialism or death, and they stuck it through. Yes, there was an opening, but it was then reeled back, and political control was paramount. And I think we need to remember that too as we consider this. Yes, the logic suggests that they should. That doesn't mean that they necessarily will. And, you know, there are political considerations which are perhaps in the air again, you know, following Fidel Castro's death, that, you know, we shouldn't assume that just because that looks like the most logical path, that's what they should do.
Pascal, describe there's sort of a fork in the road, let's say, right now after Fidel's death. What are the two paths that Raul Castro and this very elderly Cuban leadership could take at this point?
Well, I think Raul Castro and the leadership have made pretty clear they're not going to just suddenly switch to, you know, Western-style multi-party democracy and capitalism. Having said that, I mean, clearly there is pressure from within for change. I mean, Cubans want access to internet. Cubans want professional careers that are remunerated and to be able to exercise them privately. There's huge pressure in areas like that. So I think there is, you know, they do feel that pressure to sort of, you know, move reforms in that sort of direction, perhaps open up more in the so-called self-employed sector. In terms of, you know, control of the economy and giving up state control of the economy, I think that's a much tougher one. Everything indicates they're going to keep that. So, you know, those are that we could still see, even after Fidel's death, we could still see a bit of a closing of the ranks ideologically, and perhaps even this could even open a bit of an ideological battle within the leadership.
But what's the stronger impulse here? Does that leadership, now that Fidel is dead, do they feel less constrained and perhaps that will allow them to pursue more reform, or do they feel like they've got to protect his legacy and that will force them then to retrench? What's the stronger impulse going on there in Havana?
Well, I've heard that argument, and it's a strong argument that, you know, the red line of the big brother overlooking and saying we don't want any gifts from the United States, you know, we heard that may be removed, but I'm not sure that's gonna work through so quickly. I mean, I think that, you know, Raul and the rest of the leadership will be sensitive to, you know, keeping the legacy of Fidel. So I think we could see, as I say, a bit of a tussle. The stronger one, well, what's stronger, you know, reality or the battle of ideas? And I still think, you know, that's a tough one to work out. The battle of ideas could still be strong, and you've got a Trump administration coming in, and that might make the battle of ideas even more relevant.
Pascal, on the other side of the Florida Straits here in the United States, 2 years ago, there was a lot of criticism leveled against President Obama as he began this normalization effort. And that criticism, to some degree, came from those who said, listen, Cuba trades with the majority of the world. What's one more country going to do to the Cuban economy? In other words, even if there was American trade or more American openings with Cuba, that's not necessarily going to change anything. When you cite the economic struggles that Cuba has had, even in the past 2 years, does that give credence to those critics to say, even with expanded trade, we haven't lifted the embargo, certainly, but expanded remittances, expanded travel, more import-export, the ability to have financial relationships with the island, and yet still the economy has not necessarily seen a real significant increase in activity?
Well, I think, you know, you have to say about the Obama initiative that, you know, even though President Obama said very specifically in the recent directive that, you know, our goal is not regime change, I think there might be a little bit of doublespeak there. I think the long-term bet is a significant change in Cuba's economy and politics. And I think that underlines the Obama. It's just a question of how you do it. They felt that engagement was the best way to do it. Seduction, engagement, getting close and influence. Obviously now, you know, that sort of bet is off with possibly with the Trump administration. Mm-hmm. So, and on the Cuban side, they were wise to that. I mean, it's interesting how much since Obama's visit, just how much his initiative was being criticized inside Cuba by the leadership and the state media saying, careful, this looks like a Trojan horse. You know, even they criticized it a lot and you felt they were resisting. I mean, even to the point where, you know, a very sort of significant hoped for investment, which was the tractor investment in the Mariel free trade zone by this Cuban American gentleman, the clever investment.
Right,
you know,
right. The company based in Alabama.
They decided to turn it down. I thought that was perhaps betting on a Hillary Clinton victory in the U.S. election, and I think that, you know, it was clear they were resisting even the Obama engagement. So, you know, let's see, as I say, that again raises the question, what might happen with the Trump administration?
Pascal Fletcher was the Caribbean bureau chief for Reuters. He was the Cuba correspondent for the Financial Times. He's with us here on the Sunshine Economy talking about changing Cuba. Still to come on our program, how one Cuban considers himself both a revolutionary and reformist among all the changes. That's next. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy. Changing Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett. In the span of 2.5 weeks last month, the future of U.S.-Cuba relations went from knotty to unknown. First, Donald Trump was elected president in the United States with the help of Cuban-American voters. More than half of them in Florida supported Trump, according to exit polls conducted by Edison Research. At a campaign stop in September in Miami, Trump promised a better deal with Cuba if elected.
All of the concessions that Barack Obama has granted the Castro regime were done through executive order, which means the next president can reverse them. And that I will do unless the Castro regime meets our demands. Not my demands, our demands. You know what the demands are.
Those demands include religious and political freedoms and the release of political prisoners. Now, the second event that may change the relationship, the death of Fidel Castro. While he hadn't been in power for a decade, the economic and political systems remain his constructs. His ideological DNA remains embedded throughout the policies and practices of bureaucrats responsible for the official Cuban economy, even as Cubans stretch the boundaries of past reforms.
I met Cariel Gonzalez back in March in Havana. He had just watched President Obama's speech from the Gran Teatro on a TV in the city's Vedado section. Gonzalez is the sort of revolutionary but reform-minded Cuban who can perhaps best help the U.S. influence change in Cuba. He was impressed by the way Obama challenged Cuba's elderly communist leadership to give Cubans more democratic and economic freedoms, including access to the internet. So when I returned to Cuba last month during the government-mandated mourning period after Fidel Castro's death, I met up with Gonzalez again. This time we had lunch at the Havana Libre Hotel. He was getting ready to celebrate his 35th birthday the next day. We talked about where relatively young Cubans like him think reform is going, especially economic change, and also how nervous Cubans are about Donald Trump.
The big hope for them is that Obama opened.
When you first talk to Cariel Gonzalez, he seems like a typical pro-government Cuban. He's an accounting professor at the University of Havana, and while he may not exactly worship the late Fidel Castro, he backs the social aims of Castro's communist revolution. And he didn't like seeing Cuban Americans in Miami celebrating Castro's death and U.S. President-elect Donald Trump trashing El Comandante on Twitter as a brutal dictator.
I support the revolution. The tweets from Trump, they hurt most Cubans. I would dare to say that. When President Reagan was shot, we did not enjoy that, have fun with that, even though President Reagan was one of the greatest enemies of Cuban revolution.
One significant difference is Reagan was shot by a would-be assassin, whereas Fidel presumably died a natural death. But while Gonzalez is no dissident, he's certainly no communist ideologue. And while, like many Cubans, he might support the revolution Fidel founded, like most Cubans, he's not happy with the regime Fidel left behind, especially its geriatric communist leaders known as Los Históricos.
Yeah, it's true. We have to change. We have to evolve. I mean, the world has changed. Many young people here in Cuba, they want to have a new, fresh revolution, freedom to speak freely, freedom to meet, the freedom of business, especially for the entrepreneurs, and the access to the internet, but they are not allowed. The historical leaders are paralyzing the process. You can keep the achievement of the revolution, but you can have a market economy and exchange opinions. The historical leaders, they have the idea that that's bad, that's going to destroy the revolution, and it's not like that.
Gonzalez, in fact, consults Cuba's growing legion of private entrepreneurs, who he believes are the key to the island's economic future and who he thinks need to be unshackled from onerous government restrictions and regulations.
Since we have private businesses, they have helped most things. People are, let's say, happier. You can go on the streets, you can eat something here, you can go there, you can go to a bar, you can go to enjoy something. And I'm not becoming anti-revolutionary for that. And like me, there are many people who think like that. We're going to stay in Cuba, we're going to help Cuba, but let's help it this way.
Which is why Gonzalez says a lot of Cuban entrepreneurs, or cuentapropistas, aren't exactly following Cuba's regulations to the letter. For example, as part of the two-year-old normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations, Washington says Americans can now invest with, export to, and import from cuentapropistas. Technically, the government of Cuban President Raul Castro still doesn't permit that. But Gonzalez says many of his cuentapropista clients really don't care, like one private restaurateur he consults.
He has a small cafeteria, a parador. What do you call a parador? He imports things from Miami, the kitchen, everything. There is a business of import and export between Cuba and Miami, let's say that, which is not legal, but it's not illicit. You know, there's a difference in that. And many of the small businesses we have in Cuba, it's been funded, financed from people who are living in Miami. You can call it anything, but that exists.
Gonzalez says that situation reflects the Cuban government's nervousness about foreign investment in general, which it still keeps at bay despite the island's serious economic crisis and despite the fact that other socialist regimes around the world, like China and Vietnam, have let it flow into their countries.
There are people here in Cuba that they have some positions that if a normal relations exist with the United States, too many things are going to change and too many privileges are going to be lost. People who decide who can invest in Cuba, who doesn't. And I would dare to say that there are people who are receiving money for that. Influence traffic. So if you allow the American companies, for instance, to come to Cuba and to invest whatever they want and how they please, they are going to lose that power. There's also many people who are very ideological and they still see that the United States is the bad guy of the movie.
But it's not just Cuban communists who see a potential bad guy in the person of Donald Trump, who recently suggested he'd terminate President Obama's normalization of U.S.-Cuba relations unless Cuba produces more democratic reform. Gonzalez says if that were to happen, the U.S. would be abandoning the one group that has achieved a measure of independence from the Cuban regime, cuentapropistas.
I've talked to one of the entrepreneurs here in Cuba, and he said, it's something incoherent. United States is promoting private business. So if Trump closes that door, he would be against his own interests. We're waiting until Trump takes office. But small businesses are afraid of Trump. There's an open door, and we don't want that to be shut. If Trump closes that door, there's no opportunity at all. It would hurt us. If Trump turns back on us, you're going to prove right all those people in the Cuban government who are saying, hey, look, the United States, they are not our friends.
Even so, Gonzalez doesn't see the Cuban regime moving ahead with much reform now that Fidel is gone. And he thinks much won't happen until 2018, when the 85-year-old Raul Castro says he'll hand the presidency to a younger leader. By that time, Raul will have been in power for 12 years.
I think that until 2018, everything is going to be just like it has been up to now. After 2018, then I think we're going to see real changes.
The question is whether the U.S. will still have a presence in Cuba that will allow it to help influence those changes, or whether that presence will have been terminated. I should mention, Tom, that Cariel Gonzalez is so enthusiastic about helping those cuentapropistas engage U.S. business that his smartphone has about 10 English language instruction apps on it.
Still to come on our program, from exile to entrepreneur to public company owner, Perry Ellis, International Executive Chairman George Feldenkrais, on how Cuba needs private businesses.
Entrepreneurs need the freedom to be entrepreneurs.
This is the Sunshine Economy, Changing Cuba. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Paget. George Feldenkrais says his grandfather wound up in Cuba in the 1920s after leaving what today is Ukraine. He was headed for the U.S. but didn't make it as America restricted immigration in the years after World War I. It would be about four decades later when Feldenkrais would make it to the U.S. in 1961, escaping the Castro Revolution with $700 and his wife, who was 8 months pregnant.
He started importing motorcycle and auto parts. A few years later, he began in the clothing business, growing it eventually into Perry Ellis International over the course of four decades, holding brands like Genuine Penguin, Jansen, and others. The company now sells almost $1 billion worth of merchandise a year. His is the story that fuels entrepreneurs.
Entrepreneurs need the freedom to be entrepreneurs.
Feldenkrais was initially leery about President Obama's changes to America's Cuba policy, but now he says he's convinced they're the best way the U.S. can help influence change on the island. Among the Cuban entrepreneurs he has met is Caridad Limonta. I first met her when she visited Wynwood in 2015 to learn about online commerce. I spoke with her again in late November in Havana.
I can't separate my success as an entrepreneur from the preparation the revolution gave me, Limonta says, but I want my country to change and improve.
She owns and runs Procle, a clothing company, a business Feldenkrais knows well.
She used to go to the hotels and buy the sheets that they were going to throw out because they had holes, they had this, they had that. And she took those sheets and dyed them in color and started to make dresses. And she would go then to the resort and sold those dresses. And lo and behold, she started to make a living. And as a matter of fact, she's coming to Miami and she told me the other day she's making a living out of it.
But Feldenkrais says her experience as a Cuban entrepreneur symbolizes the struggles of trying to develop private enterprise in an economic system that squeezed out private businesses for more than 50 years.
That lady could really develop a real good business if she could. She was able to import fabric and import thread and whatever notion they need. It's not only that. You need a hanger, a plastic hanger, which is not made in Cuba. You need polybag, they need labels, etc. So to make a garment, you need a series of vendors or products that you have to be making locally or be able to buy it, import it. You know, how do you provide enough freedom for that woman? Can this woman come to a bank and borrow, or if she made it, she told me, please bring me a container of white thread. I will be able to sell it in one day if you can bring it in.
But aside from bringing her thread, what can American apparel entrepreneurs like yourself do to help that private apparel sector in Cuba?
So you are going to need a process to do it, either in partnership with the government, which is a problem, and you can understand why, or some freedom to be able to buy foreign exchange and be able to do things. And if you don't have that, it's really very difficult.
Have the efforts by the Obama administration in the past 2 years of these normalization efforts of relaxing some export and import rules and relaxing financial rules regarding banking for Cubans in the United States, how have those at all impacted the kind of response from American businesses to those Cuban entrepreneurs and perhaps the ability of U.S. business folks like yourself to engage with the Cuban entrepreneurs on the island?
Well, any relaxation is good, and I think it has been very good for the tourist industry of Cuba. So it has helped in that sense, but other than that, there haven't been any, as far as I know, other than in the tourist industry, there hasn't been any relaxation. The embargo is still on. Very unlikely that it would be lifted in the short term. I don't see much progress in that sense if the Cuban government doesn't adapt new policies. So there is a number of things that have to be done in order for it to really establish a situation where private business can really flourish. And I think that if they do, it's going to flourish very quickly because Cuba has a better educated workforce than other countries in Latin America. The proximity to the United States is crucial to the improvement.
Some of the goals of the Obama administration's efforts, stated goals, has been to stimulate and support that entrepreneurial spirit that you identified and some of the Quinto Propistas that you have met and spoken to. 2 years on, it faces an uncertain future with the new administration, with Donald Trump coming into the White House. What do you see for the future of that engagement?
I will leave that to the future. I don't think that the new administration is going to be as tough as Mr. Trump has talked about it. It just isn't possible, practically. High tariffs are only going to damage the American consumer.
But do American executives like yourself really believe that Mr. Trump could sever the new U.S. relations with Cuba to the extent that he suggested he might?
Frankly, that's a very difficult decision. We have to see who's going to be the new Secretary of State also. It's an important decision. So I think that Mr. Trump appears to be, up to now, when it comes to issues, a pragmatist. And that's why you're going to be changed. You see him already changing so much and doing things that you didn't expect from him. I think he's a pragmatist, he's a businessman. He knows in the long run that it's good to negotiate a deal, but not to lose a deal.
When President Obama made the initial normalization announcement 2 years ago in December of 2014 to today, and as we sit, we are more than a week after the death of Fidel Castro and still about 6 weeks or so away from the inauguration of President Trump. How has your emotions changed or expectations changed over the course of the 2 years? And as we sit here today, if at all, given your very personal connection to Cuba and your professional interest in it?
Well, it had been, I think for the Cuban people, had been good in general. It has reestablished a sense of that the Americans are not as bad as they were told that they are, that they don't have horns or anything in their head, that they are normal people, that they can be good people rather than the monsters that we... And that also helped the Miami Cuban that we are no longer considered worms, gusanos. So that's all on the positive side. And I think it's a progress. And from a tourist standpoint, again, has been very good. It's establishing more relationships. And that gives hope to people. It's very important to bring... The key issue is hope.
A group of Cuban entrepreneurs was in Washington, D.C. last week, urging President-elect Trump to continue allowing American travel and trade with Cuba. One of those was Marta Elisa Deus. I first met her this past summer when she participated in FIU's Incubando program. That was a pilot project hosting 15 young Cuban entrepreneurs, providing them with American-style business classes. Deus was born in Cuba but left for Spain when she was 12. She came back to Cuba to start her accounting business, and she doesn't think Cuba is her only opportunity. Here she is this summer.
Miami is a huge market for me because Cubans that live here can open their own business in Havana. Maybe they will need me.
She now has three companies in Cuba, an accounting firm, a delivery company, and a business magazine.
Still to come, is there ground between today's relations and cutting off all commerce again? That's next on the Sunshine Economy. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, talking about changing Cuba. Thanks again for listening today.
And I'm Tim Padgett. 16 years before Donald Trump announced the campaign for president that would carry him to the White House, he came to Miami and spoke to the Cuban American National Foundation. It was a pro-embargo speech to a group supporting the trade embargo.
You will win. You are going to win. And I'm going to be down here and I'm going to watch you win. I don't know what capacity I'll be. I'll either be the greatest developer in the country or the greatest president that you've had in a long time. I'm not sure.
That was Donald Trump in 1999 here in South Florida in Miami. In 2016, of course, Trump won the White House with an estimated 54% of the Cuban American vote. Francisco Pepe Jose Hernandez, is the president of the Cuban American National Foundation, and he's with us here. Pepe, welcome to the program. Were you in the room in 1999? Do you remember that speech?
Certainly. And we welcome Mr. Trump when he arrived, and he was very pleasant, very nice. And interesting enough, I still remember the fact that he came with an entourage with people with shirts, and he would change his shirt every 15 or 20 minutes. Anyways, it was a very interesting meeting, and he certainly, you heard what he said, and he was adamant about the idea of maintaining the embargo and not doing business in Cuba. I mean, we were a little bit surprised because at that time we didn't know that allegedly 7 months before that meeting with us, he had been sending some of his people to Cuba.
To Cuba, right. And there have been reports that even within the past year, there has been some conversations at some level at the Trump Organization regarding a hotel business, hospitality interests in Cuba. But yet now, as president-elect, as we have said, just days after Fidel Castro's death, the president-elect tweeted out that if he doesn't get a better deal for the Cuban people and for the American people, he will terminate President Obama's normalization efforts. What would that mean for Cubans on the island if what has changed in the past 2 years is reversed?
Well, it would mean what Mr. Trump, or President-elect Trump now, means about a better deal. If really a better deal is to improve the situation of the Cuban people, look for some elements of change in the administration or the regime, the Cuban regime, specifically in their treatment of the rights, the human rights of the Cuban people, and the arrests and the beatings that have taken place, and since 2014 has increased tremendously, actually, in Cuba. So if that is a portion of it, I think that yes, we agree that it would be a very positive development in the policy of the United States. If it is to go back to the time before the administration, the Obama administration, mm-hmm. Changes and reapproachment of some sort toward the Cuban government, then I think it would be a mistake. I think that a middle road in which some of the positive elements of the Obama administration policy were to continue or being expanded, I think it would be right.
But Pepe, when Trump talks about a better deal, I think there's also an economic component as well as a human rights and democratic reform component to it. I think he and his camp would also like to see just the Cuban regime offer something, put something on the table that it hasn't done yet. For example, it keeps insisting the U.S. has to drop the trade embargo, but the U.S. Congress is saying, well, we need to see something ponied up from Cuba first. For example, action on property claims. If Cuba would just show some action on repaying those property reparations, what the Cuban Revolution stole, that might move things forward. Why is it so hard for the Cuban regime, do you think, to see the sense in that?
Okay, the Cuban government has continuously based its policy toward the rest of the world, but specifically to the United States, on a cost-benefit analysis, mm-hmm. if you may. How much of what I give is going to cost me? And what they interpret as a cost is the control that they can release of their economy, which they control completely or almost completely, and of the Cuban people. And therefore, when we see that the U.S. government offer a number of concessions and expecting the Cuban people, the Cuban government, to actually reply with also some concessions, the reality is that for the Cuban government, the control it's over their people is a lot more important than the concessions that it can that they can obtain from the U.S. government.
Pepe, where is that middle ground that your organization, the Cuban American National Foundation, senses between the demand by the Cuban government for total control, economic and political, on the island, and what the Obama administration strategy has been, which is to ease restrictions on Americans, planting seeds of hope on the island, but also seeds of hope in the United States that the island would change? Where is that middle ground? What are some of those things that you could offer up to the Trump administration to consider?
Well, first of all, the continued interchange or people-to-people exchange that has taken place over several years now, actually since 2009,
right.
But specifically after 2014. I think that this is something that has been very positive. The ability of the United States citizens, whether Cubans or not, Cuban Americans or not, to be able to interact with the Cuban people themselves, not necessarily with the government. This is something that should be expanded, should continue, because it has helped tremendously. And it has created a very substantial and a significant expectation among the Cuban people that things can change. Actually, the remittances should continue. Mm-hmm. The question of transportation and the cruise ships and the airlines. And the airlines. This is going to reduce the cost of traveling, not only for Americans going there, but also for Cubans and also for Cubans that would sure. want to come to the United States.
Those are the executive actions that are in place right now that President-elect Trump, among the things that he has threatened to terminate if he doesn't get a better deal. Where are those middle ground places? Are there things that the current administration has done that you would prefer that President-elect Trump repeal in the weeks ahead?
Well, I don't think that the reality is that every concession that has been, or most of the concessions that have been made in terms of commercial interchange or investment, the Cuban government hasn't used them, hasn't done anything about them, and it's specifically because they are not interested in that, because they would mean a higher amount of control from the economy released by them. They would probably have to allow U.S. Companies, for example, to hire their own employees, mm-hmm. their own staff. This is something that the Cuban government doesn't want to do, because they are controlling at the present time about 70% of the Cuban economy, and a lot of that economy, it's in the hands of the military themselves. So this is going to come out to a point where President Trump is going to have to determine how they can push on some of the things that are positive for the Cuban people, and some of the things that the Cuban government will certainly not allow to happen. They are not interested in releasing at all.
Pepe, yesterday the Miami Herald reported that there are some real growing disagreements within the Cuban-American leadership, particularly the Cuban-American business leadership, about what path to take from here, whether or not the U.S. should really be engaging the Cuban government economically, whether it should just keep its focus on helping these new private entrepreneurs in Cuba. Are you aware of that growing rift within the community?
Yes, certainly, and I know a number of those on both sides of the issue, and the problem is that those who at the beginning and sincerely thought that this opening of President Obama would result in a very substantial reforms for private business to take place, for them and others to be able to really develop the economy, thinking that that would bring a tremendous amount of freedom and entrepreneurship within the Cuban people, that didn't happen. So these people are frustrated about it. And from what I hear, even those that were very adamant about following that and lifting the embargo, right now they are thinking that we should concentrate on helping the cuentapropistas,
the entrepreneurs, right?
And there are not some of them that have been dealing directly with the Cuban government for weeks on end. They now say, look, it's very frustrating. We just don't want to continue on that situation. So these are the people, and this is the situation.
We're speaking with Pepe Hernandez, president of the Cuban American National Foundation. More of our conversation as the Sunshine Economy Changing Cuba continues in a moment. Welcome back to the Sunshine Economy here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Tim Padgett. Pascal Fletcher was the Caribbean Bureau Chief for Reuters and the Cuba correspondent for the Financial Times. Francisco Pepe Jose Hernandez is the president of the Cuban American National Foundation. To both of you, Pepe and Pascal, quick question. Was 2 years really, is that really enough to realistically to think that things would have changed that much? I mean, after more than 50 years of, frankly, a failed isolation policy, was it really realistic to think that in 2 years we'd see enough change to feel that normalization had succeeded? Pascal?
Obviously, 2 years is not a long period. But having said that, I do think, many people feel that more could have come from Cuba. And, I did pick out that example of that sort of smallish, medium level tractor yeah. investment, which, was even, initiated. I think one of the partners is a Cuban American.
Yeah. That was a disappointment. Yeah.
And, why not? I mean, it did seem that the rejection of that was actually intended as a kind of, message that, we're not that interested, frankly.
Well, the Cuban regime said they'd prefer more high-tech types of things, more 21st century types of investments at the Port of Mariel, as opposed to a tractor that is based upon 1950s technology that is designed for a farm of 40 acres or less.
Still, the symbolism of that venture, I think
Pascal
makes a good point.
Politically, there was a sense that that was a bit of a poster child of the of the rapprochement. So I think, you know, I'd have to conclude that when rejecting that, they knew the disappointment that it would create. Yeah.
Pepe, how about you? 2 years, long enough for...
No, certainly not. But, you know, politics tend to interfere with time and in all these issues. And I think that the election of Donald Trump to the presidency of the United States is probably going to push this this timeline a little bit faster. I've heard from a U.S. official involved in these negotiations recently that that since the elections there have been on the part of the Cuban government a sort of fire sale on contracts things between the United States, because again they feel not that Trump is going to, they are trying to find out exactly what Trump is going to do, and nobody, even the people in the State Department, they don't know exactly what Trump is going to do. So this uncertainty is probably going to create a willingness on the part of the Cuban government to really push forward before reality becomes harsher than what it is right now.
Your assessment, Pepe, is that a President Trump could, over the next 2 years, accelerate perhaps some of the changes that the Obama administration tried to plant on the island?
Yes, I think that this could be a result of this uncertainty. Secondly, of the crisis economic crisis in which we have discussed this year with the Venezuelan situation and a number of other things, and the fact that Raul Castro, if he is going to just leave formal government in 2018, he has to place, has to do a number of decisions and place in there somebody that would continue their revolution.
Pascal Fletcher, less than a minute here. Where would you look over the next 2 years for those green shoots of hope?
Well, I mean, there have been some legislation, you know, on the Cuban side that's been kind of mooted. It's very mooted, very unclear. One is the so-called SME, you know, small and medium-sized business law giving them, you know, legal recognition. And another would be the mooted electoral law. What's that going to mean? But frankly, there's so little detail in terms of sort of the exact content or the timing of those that it's very difficult to know whether they will be employed. But I mean, those are just two things in the economic and the political area that people, you know, are looking at and hoping that maybe we'll see some developments.
Pascal Fletcher, a veteran Cuban correspondent with the Reuters and then also with the Financial Times. Pepe Hernandez is president of the Cuban American National Foundation. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Sunshine Economy today. Wanda Miles is our technical director. For Tim Padgett, I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks again for listening today.